So as we know, our God is transcendent, omnipotent, eternal, omniscient, and omnibenevolent. So transcendent means he is above and beyond. He is he's graduated into perfection, and you know that's where he started. He's omnipotent. Anyone know these words? What's omnipotent mean? Omnipotent, all powerful, potent. Yeah. So if you think of a powerful potion, that's a potent potion, powerful drink. It's potent. He is omnipotent, or omnipotent, as you know, someone learning English would say. He's eternal, so that goes on forever. And it baffles me when I try and think about eternity. It doesn't make any sense because we're not able to comprehend it from inside the timeline. And he's omniscient. He knows everything. And he's omnibenevolent. So he's all good, all generous, and has it all in hand. Everything works together for good. So previously we learned about these attributes. And since God is all powerful, we can, you know, quite rationally say he should be able to stop all bad things from happening. And that's sort of the first accusation you get, isn't it? Well, why are there bad things in the world? If there's a good God, why are there bad things in the world? And clearly bad things happen all the time, but we believe in God. So how do those two sit together in this universe? And this challenge is known as the problem of evil or the problem of suffering. And many believe there's no answer. They think the dilemma proves that the Bible is wrong. But we'll see, as we go through the session today, how the Bible actually provides the answer to the problem of suffering, while other worldviews do not manage to answer that at all. They don't have a satisfactory answer. We'll look first at the Bible explanation for suffering, and then the biblical solution to suffering. So, the problem of suffering is tied up in sin. And sin is the biggest, boldest word that will come out of it today. Sin is the powerful counter-argument to everything that is godly. And from sin comes the curse. So we've looked back in past Bible sessions about the creation of the world, about how it was created perfect. We had the Garden of Eden. We had Adam and Eve created in the image of God, perfect human beings. Nothing went wrong. Everything was great. I never had a bad hair day. It was all hunky-dory. And that's how God set things up. That's how he designed us to be, living in that environment. But there's always the quandary. If you have God creating a perfect world and putting inside of it perfect people, how do we know, or how does God know that the people in that world actually are real people? They're not just puppets. They're not just a self-aggrandizing creation. You know, if we make something that loves us unconditionally and there's nothing they can do about it, is that love for that thing, or is it a kind of slavery? And that's really the challenge that is tied up in all of this. If God was to create a world where nothing could go wrong and everybody in it would love him, then he's creating puppets. He's creating robots that do his will unconditionally. And so for there to be the possibility of love, for there to be acknowledgement of love, there had to be a potential from choosing other than God, from choosing not to be pro-God, but choosing against God. And that choice in the Garden of Eden was a single tree. And it was the one rule in the garden: don't eat of that tree. And if you ate of it, that meant you weren't a perfect being. You were choosing to go against God, who you knew was perfect, because you could see everything that was around you. And the question comes to you, what would you do in that situation? Would you have eaten that tree? The straight instinctive answer is, as every child would say, is no, stupid idea. However, as we go through life and we see, you know, the world we're living in, we know that there are many things that we've done wrong, many occasions we have sinned. And, you know, we lean towards sin and the slightest bit of pressure. And so even in that perfect world, I believe that that choice was a real choice. And Adam and Eve had that choice, had that decision to make, and they made that mistake. They chose to allow sin to enter the world. And from that point forward, we see the curse being enacted, and death and corruption, pain and suffering all came from that one yes or no decision. Do I trust God implicitly, you know, explicitly in everything I do, or do I challenge him? And that's where sin entered the world. And the second, as it's titled here, the problem of suffering, is that we have redeeming suffering. You know, the Bible story tells us that to get outside of sin, to be redeemed back to God, somebody had to suffer, which just seems very cruel. If you're outside of creation and you're making a world, why would you make the road back to me, back to relationship, a path of suffering? Couldn't you see a way around that? And again, we're going to look into points on that as we go through it. So let's first think about sin and the curse. We know Adam and Eve sinned, and we continue to sin today. We cause more pain and suffering. And because sin offends God, this hurts others, and ultimately, hurting others hurts us too. So everything we see around us that is not good, we can attribute to sin. And one of the things we can look at is human evil, so when we choose to do something wrong, or natural evil, which we see around us as well, like floods and fire and predators in the nature. All these things seem to be natural evil that's just in and of everything. But actually, we can see in the Bible, we look again, it's actually all born from sin. So one of the most challenging stories in the Bible, for me, actually, is one where Jesus is on the earth, and he's doing incredible things. He's healing people and transforming their lives. And yet one of the challenging things in that is that, well, we'll look at the story. We had Jesus and his disciples were walking down the road, and a blind man, a beggar, is on the side of the road, and the disciples ask him the question, Jesus, so who sinned in this situation? Why is this man blind? Was it him who sinned before he was even born, or was it his parents' fault? And that's sort of the crux of the question. Who, if we know that suffering and pain and disease and sickness comes from sin, then who is it that sinned? Where is it? What's the cause of it? And Jesus' tricky answer for me is it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. And that to me sort of thinks, well, this is God letting bad things happen to somebody so they can reveal himself in glory, which seems very twisted, doesn't it? If you're trying to explain that to someone who doesn't believe in God, it seems very twisted. And this, again, is very much a problem of our society today, I think, because we look at everything from our own perspective, our own, I'm self-centered in my world, I can look at this thing and see this, the injustice of it for the individual. But actually what we have to do is look at it from a higher point of view. We have to take it outside of ourselves, stop thinking about our perspective, our opinions, our thoughts, and look at it from the whole perspective of creation, of God. And that's where, you know, we really get an answer to this question. You know, it wasn't that Jesus had been set up by God to be walking on that road and just like, pow, I've just healed the man, now I'm great. It wasn't that at all, you know. It was a far greater thing going on. And in this healing, we'll find that the glory given to God is fully justified, is fully wonderful, and crucial for us to grasp in ourselves that God doesn't do bad things. Bad things happen. God stops some bad things and doesn't stop some other bad things. He doesn't intervene in anything. And again, it goes back to that whole initial picture. If God fixed every problem everywhere, would we still be living as people of free will? Would we still have a choice? Or would we just revert back to that robot position where we're slaves and we don't have any self determination? We don't decide our future. It's all done by God because he sorts all our problems out. And this is where our responsibility to act, to be involved, to be engaged in this world comes from. So let's look at natural disasters. So a tsunami is caused most often by shifting of the tectonic plates. The surface of the earth moves and there's such energy released, you know, mountains side by side scrape against each other, such energy released that it shakes the whole surface of the planet. It rises up enormous waves and washes away whole cities. There was an earthquake recently in, I forget where it was now, somewhere in Europe, Turkey, was it? And the result of the earthquake was a massive mudslide that completely covered an entire village in rocks and earth and debris. It flowed down like water. And these are, you know, people's homes, their whole lives are built up in these houses. You can imagine it happening to you, and it's like, oh, the horror. And you can think in that situation again, whose fault was it? Was it the people living there? Was it their fault? Had they sinned and caused this destruction on their own lives? Or was it their parents' fault? No, you can't find the trace back to where the earthquake started. But actually, you have to go all the way back to the beginning where sin came into the world and started to cause these fractures, these ruptures, and whole of creation was affected by the entrance of sin. Quite extraordinary entrance. So, ever since we've experienced two kinds of evil: human evil, when a human being does something sinful, like lie, steal, or murder, and natural evil, when something in nature causes harm. Examples will include diseases like cancer, or disasters like a tornado, a tsunami, and we can have conflicts over those. It's fine to feel conflicted, but we do have to rationalize and go back to our original thinking and think, yeah, all this will lead to something glorious. So in the beginning, there was no death even. So no one was going to die. Everyone was going to live in perfect harmony forever. And there would never be gravesides. There would never be somewhere to go and mourn, which is a drastically different position than where we are today. But through that original sin, death entered the world. The curse included suffering, included death, included disease, included the change to the natural environment, where thorns would rise up where there never had been any before, where the ground would become hard so it couldn't be dug easily and we couldn't grow our crops. All this was actually a result of sin entering the world. So everything hard around you can attribute back to sin. So it's, you know, it's not really our position to pick and choose and point blame and try and find the reason. Actually, it's all down to sin. Sin is here. And it's difficult. Now, of course, in creation.com content, we always look at the contrary worldview, which is predominant in our society, and that is evolution. And that evolution actually has exactly the same problem with all of this, is, what's the reason for it all? They can't answer that question. And so it's just attributed to randomness, to fate, to, you know, whatever you want to call it. And also evolution, if you do, you know, take hold of that teaching, then you're being taught that death has always been present. So we're living in long ages. millions and millions of years, and we've got this fossil record, which are hundreds of thousands of years old. We dig those up and we can carbon date them, and the death has been around for all that time. Pre-humans, there's no human history that's got, that's free of death. And if you believe in that narrative, then you're creating a whole quandary within yourself, because the Bible tells us that death came in with Adam. When Adam and Eve sinned, that's when death had started. But the fossil record and the stories that evolution tell us go back beyond before humanity, and things were still dying then. So that leaves you with that dilemma. Well, which is correct? Is it biblical truth or is it evolutionary truth? And, you know, I got to the point, I was about 18, 19, and I really, you know, was struggling with that, because all I'd had through education was, this is a theory of evolution. It answers so many questions, must be true, right? And so I dug deep. And fortunately, at that time, I found creation.com, and there were great people speaking and teaching on biblical truth and how that can be completely rationalized, justified, and scientifically proven from a different worldview. And so don't be fearful of going in and questioning anything you hear from the front here, from the front of a school, from your Bible. Question it. You're built with a brain that's designed not to be a robot. You're designed not to be a slave. You're designed to question. So be free to question. And actually what you'll find is that the more you question, the deeper you dive, the more honest heart truth answers you seek, you will find answers that are ones that you can actually base your life on. And they will give you truth and life and freedom from all these things that plague us, guilt and shame and disbelief and suffering. They can be got rid of in your life through actually truth-seeking, honestly questioning, finding honest, truthful answers. It's a feeling of liberty that you won't get from evolution and being taught what to believe, by rote. So, in evolutionary thinking, suffering has been a fact of life since it began. Since the world is filled with bad things, they often wonder how God could exist and also be good. And we know Charles Darwin. I cannot persuade myself. Charles Darwin was the guy who wrote the theory of evolution. So he was a scientist, and he didn't actually write it. He had family history all around him, and people had come up with very similar ideas, but he was the first one to really concrete it and make it a public success. He was the hype master for it, the spin doctor for evolution, and influenced all of science to a huge degree. I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created the Ichneumonidae, a group of wasps, with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars. So he was studying nature, and he saw that this wasp would come along, sting the caterpillar, lay its babies inside the caterpillar. Caterpillar would be born and then eat the caterpillar as its source of food. And it's like, if I was going to design a system, I would not design that. Therefore, I don't believe in God. And that was Charles Darwin's conclusion. And that led him to seeking truth elsewhere. And if we're going to be honest with ourselves, we've got to answer this question too. You know, if we're believing the evolutionary story, if we're believing that all these things evolved and changed, survival of the fittest, then actually this is all part of it, and we have to rationalize. How do you rationalize God in amongst that picture? Well, the truth is, again, that these wasps wouldn't have behaved like that in the Garden of Eden, that provision was made for anything and everything. It was perfect. But the corruption of nature and the there's a quote that nature is red in tooth and claw that Charles Darwin said. And that whole understanding of nature, in that it is vicious and cruel and all about survival of the fittest, get rid of the weakest link, that is a corruption of sin. And if you say it like that, it sounds like sin, doesn't it? We're taught to protect the weak, to care for the lonely and the widowed. We're taught to be compassionate, to look after our neighbor, to treat others as we would ourselves. This is a God picture. What we see in a lot of nature is not. It is being corrupted by sin. And it's very evident. And it's a struggle for people who observe it without having that original story, that original truth told to them. And so Darwin looked at that wasp and really struggled. But the truth of it is that he didn't have the full picture. So we've all seen these. And when we look at that car, do we say, let me read this. I'll get it wrong otherwise. When he asked why a loving God would make a broken world, this is Darwin, this is like asking why a car manufacturer would build this smashed vehicle. Well, that's a valid question, but the manufacturer didn't build a smashed vehicle, did they? They built a good vehicle that was perfectly capable of getting itself down the road with a competent driver. But it was the incompetent driver that ended up in the smash. And so blaming the car manufacturer for the smashed vehicle doesn't make any sense. Just like blaming God for the broken world doesn't make any sense. Pretty good, I thought. Yeah, exactly right. We were at this museum a couple of weeks ago, thanks to Alex, which was very, very fascinating. Walk around for a long time, looking at incredibly old stuff, but learning so much at every turn. It was really good. And in it, there were lots of statues, and there were archaeologists, and we were led by a guide. And he was describing how the damage to the statues in there would help determine their age and the traits of the things at the time. And so there was lots of statues from Egypt they all had beards on them originally, and they'd all been snapped off. Yeah, and we know pictures of Greek statues where the heads have been, got glue lines around the necks, or their arms are missing. And so as an adult, we know that actually, yeah, there was, either revolt against the political parties of the time, so smash the artworks, or it's just, things get broken over time as it happens. But a child could be in the museum and easily say, all the adults are saying this statue's beautiful, all I see is a broken statue. It's not beautiful in the eye of someone who's innocent. But that's, again, without that full picture, without knowledge, without that perspective, you can misinterpret what you're seeing and not give it the credit that it's due. And so it's important to always look from that greater perspective. So non-Christians do know that the world is messed up. Things are not the way they should be. They do realize that this is exactly what the Bible teaches. Sorry, what they don't realize is that this is exactly what the Bible teaches. We live in a fallen world, so we can show others that the Bible explains both the good and the bad parts of the world. The Bible gives the best explanation for the way things actually are. And wasn't expecting that one. There we go. Okay, so atheism, not believing in God, doesn't solve the problem, doesn't answer any questions. And one of the most common questions, both reasons atheists give for rejecting God, is that problem of suffering. They will appeal to emotions and say, can you stand next to the bed of a child dying from cancer and say that there's a good God? And again, a challenging question, really challenging question. But we have to be able to get across that answer that actually it's nothing to do with the child, it's nothing to do with the parents of the child. Cancer is a disease that's spawned about through environmental pollution and sometimes genetic mutations, and all these can trigger, conspire into an innocent child being born prone to cancers. And that's a part of the whole picture going back to the original sin again. Sin came into the world, things started to decay, to deteriorate. In fact, all our genetic diseases are attributed back to the shallowing of the gene pool and mutation.
Excuse me.
Mutations happening in them, and our body suffering as a result. And that is a problem for everybody who doesn't have that full picture again. So be ready with the answer to think about how do you explain to others that actually there's a full and earlier picture going on that you need to know and learn and understand. And denying God doesn't solve the problem of evil. It only throws away the answer. So if you are an atheist or you are in conversation with an atheist and they've thrown away God because of the evil that they see, does it give them a fresh answer? Does it give them something better? It just takes away the potential for an answer. And that, you know, there is an answer to be had here. There is a creator. There is something that is outside of our understanding right now, who sees all, understands all, is all loving, all good, and all knowing. And if you throw that away, then your perspective on life is pretty bleak. So, you know, I wouldn't want to be an atheist. Not a lot of fun. So, I do want to get to the good part. So, skip a few things. So, Genesis 50, verse 20. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So this is where God's perspective is. He's not looking at the sin that's happening right here, right now, in front of him. He's not looking at the blind man and thinking, well, who sinned? Who's to blame? Who's being, you know, which whose justice is falling on, or whose judgment is falling on this man? He looks at it all, and as evil is intended against an individual, God meant it for good. So when you see evil in the world, even when we see bad things happen, God can look at those and see actually there can be good that comes from this. And so he's always thinking, where do I intervene? Where there is no good that can be done, and I believe that's what God's position is. If I intervene here, and there'll be no, or if I don't intervene here, and there'll be no benefit to anybody, and it'll just be deteriorating into more and more disease, disaster, and decay, I won't intervene. You know, I will intervene. I will make sure that there is a, you know, an upside in every story, every condition, every bit of suffering. There is an upside to it, and if I see that I can intervene and that's the only option for there to being upside, I believe that's when really God acts, you know, without question. But what he is always looking at is that whole picture. And actually, if, you know, we're in a fallen world, and the thing that most strikes to me is that if I am struggling with something and someone comes alongside me who's never struggled with that thing, it doesn't really matter what they say. I won't really hear it. I will maybe understand and rationally can think it. But until I've had someone come alongside me who's suffered with the same problem, who's experienced that same pain, that's the only time I can really understand and get healing from that person, from that person and not the first. And it's a matter of experience. Part of us, part of our humanity is tied up in empathy and understanding others because you've gone through it yourself. And you know, we're taught as Christians that we are not going to have an easy life. It's not going to be all perfect. We are going to have the flaming arrows of the evil one sent our way. And I believe that if God intervened and shielded us from every arrow, kept us in a perfect place, again, we would never get out of our zones. We'd never have anything to contribute to those around us who are suffering, who haven't heard the good news yet. So in any, you know, any opportunity where you feel like, oh, this is too much, I'm suffering, think about it. Okay, where am I going to be in a year's time? If I'm alive still, what am I going to have from this that will be an absolute gold mine for the next person I talk to about something they're struggling with? And, you know, try and process things from God's perspective and not just look at it from your own current perspective, because it's only by doing that can we actually see where the value in our suffering is. And we do suffer. We are going to suffer. but we need to get value from it. We need to think, right, this is not going to stay this way. God means this for good in some way, shape, or form. Let's find it, let's process it, let's learn from it, and let's make it into a tool for helping someone else out of the hole that they may be in down the road. And I believe that that's a powerful way to approach life, to approach suffering, to think about where is the good. And if you just have that intention right from the outset, where is the good, you'll find it. It's, in all suffering there is opportunity. And it's a puzzle, it's a mystery, but God sees it all. He is all-knowing, and he understands where that good is, and he can find it, and he can help you make, he can leverage to the best. Now, we know the story of Joseph and his brothers, and he was the golden child. His dad loved him the best. He got the best jacket, and life was rosy for Joseph, until his brothers, who got really jealous because they didn't get a nice posh coat, they said, right, we're going to sell you into slavery. And that story was a nice story to me all the way along. But then actually, once we were at the British Museum and we were hearing about some of the conditions of cities and civilizations at the time, being sold into slavery was the worst possible thing that could happen to an individual. Some of the gruesome stories of warring nations and the way that humans treat humans, kings treat their subjects, just the worst. I mean, we think we have it bad these days when we've got Elon Musk and Donald Trump falling out and shouting at each other on their own individual social media platforms. It's embarrassing, but it's not as bad as you being sold into slavery by your brothers. So, let's look for the good in the fact we've got moronic leaders. There's some somewhere, I'm sure we'll find it. But for Joseph, he was given the biggest opportunity to kick against God and say, look, you may have treated me right to begin with, but you've just sold me into slavery. You've let my own brothers sell me to slavery. And now I'm going to be working, or if I survive, I'll be working in the lowest tier of society. I will never have my freedom. And I'm doing it in Egypt. And we know what's going on in Egypt. Crocodiles and hippos, and they're building massive things and no one knows what the point is. And I'm being sold into that. What on earth is going to happen? But Joseph stayed upbeat. Joseph stayed positive. And from that position of abject, humiliation, he got spotted. He got noticed. His attitude got him favor in the eyes of his masters. And he was raised up to the second most powerful position in Egypt. Now, if that's not a redemption story and God turning something evil to good, I don't quite know what is. A remarkable turnaround. And that's what, God's perspective is. It's like, right, okay, this bad thing's happened. Do I stick my oar in now? Or can I see where this will go and what the potential is? And, God saw the potential in that condition of suffering for Joseph then. Allowed him to stay in slavery until the time was right and he was brought back to, far higher than his original position. Truly remarkable. And that is what God is looking to do, the same for each and every one of us in every situation we are. Because we've got this redeeming verse in Romans. Paul says, and we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good. For those who are called according to his purpose. How many things are worked together for good? All things. Does all things include bad things? Yeah. All things work together for good. Now that's a magician at work. It can make every bad thing be turned for good. And that's what God is doing. He's turning all for good. Every bad thing that happens, he's got a bigger picture in mind. He's got a redemption story lined up. He's got that miracle waiting to happen. So remarkable. And so, this verse is small, but it is incredibly, all-encompassing and radical, really. Good or bad, he takes them and works them together for our good. And there's even better news. Evil is temporary. So bad things are going to stop. We're going to get to the point where there is no bad thing. No evil can happen. That is God's ultimate goal. That's our destination for every one of us who've acknowledged Jesus. Now that is a good future, isn't it? It's like that orange advert. Future is orange. Well, it's brighter than orange. We're going full on nuclear flare. No evil, no suffering, no pain. And, you know, like when I was 25, 6, something like that, I think it was, one of my friends who I worked with, I knew him from university, worked with him in business, had their first child, and their first child died. And it was absolutely devastating for them, for me. Went to the funeral, was asked to speak and or do a Bible reading at the funeral. It was, you know, really difficult. Just, you know, how do people see God in all of this? But I read the verse that, oh, I forget where it is now, I think it's Corinthians, where God is describing that there will be no more pain, no more suffering, every tear shall be wiped from their eye. Revelation, is it? Okay, Revelation, maybe we can find that. It's quite easy to find, just Google it. And John's father came up to me, who'd heard me read that scripture in the service, and said that it had meant a lot to him. Thank you for finding it, and that it would give him some peace and comfort. And it was like, oh, how can you have peace and comfort from anything when you're, you know, lost a your first grandchild? But it did. It made a difference. You know, I hadn't been in that position. I hadn't understood it. But you know, the remarkable thing is that God has. You know, God sent Jesus to earth. Jesus went through life and experienced everything that he possibly could. You know, anything that any human has ever been through, Jesus has had the equivalent happen to him. Whether that is physical, spiritual, emotional, he's experienced it all. It's a dramatic thing for a God to have done, to have come to earth and said, right, I'm going to feel exactly what you feel. I'm going to suffer the same pain, the same, you know, whether it's mine or small, I'm going to go through all that same awkwardness, embarrassment, pain, suffering, disease, and death. I'm going to go through it all. And that is a very different God. You know, that's not a God that I would invent. It doesn't sound all powerful for him to go to earth and be killed by his creation. Well, I mean, that's not a sci-fi story. This is something different. This is the God of our belief, our faith. He is not like any other. You know, he's not created, he's not written, he is, and he always will be. He has a plan for removing evil, and he's executing it to every measure, to the extent that he will have himself incarnate as a human, go to earth, suffer under sin and death, which he had nothing to do with. He didn't sin, he didn't do anything that would, you know, we could look at his parents and say, you know, that's why he's suffering it. He didn't do anything that would lead to suffering after him, but he still suffered all the consequences of dying on that cross, of being physically, you know, damaged, bruised, and you know, I believe he went through everything that we did, and he came out of it with that redemption plan complete, that resurrection plan complete. And there is quite a bit more, but I think I should wrap up. And there's one quote from a theologian called John Stott, and he says, I've turned to that lonely, twisted, tortured figure on the cross, nails through hands and feet, back lacerated, limbs wrenched, brow bleeding from thorn pricks, mouth dry and intolerably thirsty, plunged in God-forsaken darkness. Now that's the God for me. He laid aside his immunity to pain. He entered our world of flesh and blood, tears and death. He suffered for us. our sufferings become more manageable in the light of his. There is still a question mark against human suffering, but over it, we boldly stamp another mark, the cross. And I thought, you know, that was a really good summation of where we're at. We are in a sinful world. We are still suffering. We will suffer more, but we will have that cross before us at every turn. We have that redemption story. There is a future with no evil, with no suffering, with no pain, and no fear. And it's ours. We've already, you know, we've already asked into it, and so it's now ours. And that's all it takes, is just a request. You know, you don't have to work hard at being a Christian. It just is a, you know, yes, I think I'll have that. And that's how simple it is. And everything that comes after it is just a working and a renewing and a refreshing and a making you most useful in relaying that message on elsewhere. So, you know, take heart, whatever you're going through at the moment. God has a future for you that is great, that is powerful, that will give you something that will help other people that no one else could help. There'll be a situation, a time where you can use your past to help others. And, you know, look for the good. Look for the story within everything you're going through, and it will come. God is good.
All the time.
All the time. Amen. So, Lord, we just thank you for your word. Thank you for your sacrifice. We remember it. We're excited to look for the opportunities in what's ahead of us. No matter what we've been through, what we're going through, we have opportunities ahead of us and to be useful for you. And so we look for that with excitement. And as we move now to take communion, we want to bear that in mind and have that bright future, but remembering the work we have to do while we're here as well. So we just praise you, Lord. Amen.